tonight. Today we are going to be in the book of Genesis, chapter 27 and chapter 28. And we are going to be starting with verse 41 of chapter 27. We did the beginning of the chapter previously, so we don't need to do that again, obviously. And I hope that everyone can bear with me today. I've had a pretty nasty cold all week and actually lost my voice for several days, so I'm just now getting it back, and I hope that that you can bear with me. One of the nice things about doing sermons in this format is that if I, you know, lapse into a horrible coughing fit, I can at least cut it out before we publish this online. Now, we have been studying the book of Genesis, believe it or not, for 6 months now. If you have listened to all of the sermons on Genesis that we have so far, you've probably listened to about 12 hours worth of material. So I'd like to go back and get a quick recap on what's important in Genesis to make sure that we keep our frame of reference, because it's at this point that we start to say, what are we talking about here? First off, if we were to go back through Genesis, the first most important thing that we're going to see is that God created the world, including humans, and that he made us without sin. Of course, humanity fell into sin, and God promised to send one of Eve's offspring to crush the head of the serpent, which we are to see as the defeat of sin. So the overarching theme that is set up for the Bible and for the book of Genesis is the introduction of sin into the world and ultimately the destruction of sin from the world. Now, of course, generations after the Garden of Eden, a global flood demonstrated that the problem of sin cannot be solved through physical means alone. So then, we proposed two solutions to the problem of sin. Temporally, sin is to be restrained through the implementation of just laws. The book of Genesis demonstrates to us many times the need for such laws, which we will ultimately find in the rest of the Torah or the Pentateuch. Eternally, however, we know that sin is cleansed by the coming Messiah, Jesus Christ. And we will get to that when we get to the New Testament. So we have a very large book to expound primarily on these two main principles. Now then, in order to bring about the rule of just laws and the eternal cleansing of sin, God set apart Abraham and his family by a covenant, declaring that all of the world would be blessed through them. And we understand this to be an allusion to the coming Messiah. Abraham fathered Isaac and Ishmael. Isaac was chosen and Ishmael was rejected. Isaac likewise had two sons, Jacob and Esau, and last week Jacob stole Esau's blessing. So this week we're going to be talking about the conflict between Jacob and Esau, and we'll delve into God's covenant with Jacob, demonstrating clearly that God chose him to be the father of the coming Messiah and the people through whom all the world will be blessed. So then, let's get right into the story. Jacob will now be forced to flee. Esau wants to have him killed. We read this in Genesis chapter 27, verse 41. He has a plan to kill him. Now, why does he want to kill him? Because Jacob, as we discussed last week, stole Esau's blessing. When is he going to do this? He's going to do it after the death of their father, Isaac. Now, it is a very poor thing for Esau to want to do. Isaac has cursed anyone who curses Jacob. So for Esau to go after Jacob and try to kill him in order to get his father's blessing is a little bit backward. It's not the right thing for him to try and do, but that's what he's decided that he is going to do. Now, we should note, of course, that Esau never follows through on the plan. I know that's a spoiler, but years later, when Esau has an opportunity, he isn't going to take it. Later on, he is actually going to forgive Jacob for stealing the blessing. Now, whether Esau would have actually gone through with the plan had he had the opportunity immediately, we don't know, because Esau blows his plan. In verse 42, he has loose lips, and by saying the plan aloud, the plan becomes known. It is revealed to Rebekah, and Rebekah in turn warns Jacob. So Rebekah, in verses 43 through 45, warns Jacob to flee. She warns him to flee to Haran and to stay with her brother Laban, whom you may remember from previous sermons. He appeared when Rebekah married Isaac. Now, this is intended to be a temporary flight, just until Esau is no longer angry. Jacob is hoping to just hide out for a while, but the circumstances, which we will discuss in detail next week, end up making his flight much, much longer than it was originally intended to be. So, Rebekah sets her plan into action and excuses Jacob to leave on the grounds that he must find a wife for himself in Haran. Now, this is sensible for several reasons. First off, Isaac himself took a wife from Haran rather than from the people of the land of Canaan, whom they find to be deplorable. Esau's wives were taken from the land of Canaan, and they were despised by Isaac and Rebekah, as we have discussed previously. Now, there is, however, a major distinction to be made between Isaac's taking of Rebekah and Jacob's taking a wife from Haran, and this is going to be more important next week than this week. But Isaac's marriage was arranged by a trusted servant, whereas Jacob's marriage will be chosen by Jacob himself. So it's the difference between a marriage by choice and a marriage by arrangement. And these two stories are very consequential for those who are interested in biblical marriage, because they allow a certain anecdotal but pointed contrast between arranged marriages and marriages of choice. Of course, we'll get into that discussion next week. What matters today is that they are similar enough that Isaac sees this as a very reasonable plan. And so Isaac takes the bait, and so Isaac commands Jacob to take a wife from among Rebekah's nieces, or Jacob's cousins, and orders him not to take a Canaanite wife. In addition, in verses 3 and 4 of chapter 28, Isaac bestows a blessing on Jacob, a blessing of plentiful offspring, and of the other divine promises to Abraham, including divine protection, a special relationship with God, and that Jacob's offspring would ultimately be a blessing to all the earth. This, of course, fulfilled through Christ. He also blesses him with possession of the land of Canaan. And hereafter, Jacob leaves for Haran. Now, we have a short interlude discussing Esau's wives. Now, last week we talked extensively about Esau's wives, but we managed to overlook this passage in which he takes one, Mahalath, as a wife. Now, the most significant thing about Mahalath is that she is a daughter of Ishmael, okay? That, of course, is interesting to us because he already has a wife who is a daughter of Ishmael, one Basmath. Now, there was a great deal of confusion surrounding Basmath, which we discussed previously. There may have been two Basmaths, or there may have been one Basmath who had a confusing lineage. There are solutions for Basmath, and I don't want to dig too deeply into them, but the point is that it's possible that this Mahalath is an alternate name for one of the Basmaths, who may have also had the alternate name Ada. We also speculated that if there is one Basmath who is the granddaughter of both Elon the Hittite and a daughter of Ishmael, then perhaps this Mahalath is a daughter of Ishmael by another wife of Ishmael's who is not of Canaanite descent, and in that way marrying her might have been a good way to please Esau's parents. Regardless, we've gone far enough into the weeds with Esau's wives. He had at least four of them and as many as six who were named in the scripture. Some of them may have had the same name, some of them may have used multiple names. The point is that Esau's marriages were a bit of a complicated mess, but there are viable solutions amid the confusion. And in studying the Bible, Esau's wives are not the most important topic of discussion and will probably never come up again. However, we are discussing Esau's wives today because they do matter in some sense for this passage. Essentially because while Jacob is being compared to his father Isaac in taking a bride from Haran, Esau is being compared to Ishmael. Now, what is so important about that? Isaac is the son of the promise, as Jacob is the son of the promise, and Ishmael was the rejected son, and so it is with Esau, and their family alignment shows this fact. So while the names of Esau's wives are not very important, Esau's marriage does matter because it shows us the Messiah's lineage, and that is part of the book of Genesis and its entire point. So Jacob is the chosen son, Esau is not. He's definitively related to the unholy line of Ishmael, if you will. I don't know if we call it unholy, but the not the child of the promise. So then, having clearly set up those lines, we now move on to discuss Jacob as the recipient of the promise. We have a narrative beginning in verse 10 and running through the rest of the chapter here, in which Jacob stops on his way to Haran to camp one night, and he is visited by God himself. Now, one very quick interesting note from verses 10 and 11 is that Jacob sleeps using a stone as a pillow. This, of course, is something that everyone raises an eyebrow to today. But incidentally, ancient peoples often used hard objects like stone or wood or porcelain in the Far East as pillows. The primary purpose of these pillows, or so I have read, was not to support the head so much as it was to keep bugs out of the hair and face. I know that's not very pleasant to think about for modern peoples, but the kind of soft stuffing that we have today was less widely available, and cloth, which is used to make a covering for that soft stuffing, made without machines, was very expensive, and so soft pillows were not commonly used by anyone but the very wealthy until the time of the Industrial Revolution. So while we think it's very strange to use a stone as a pillow, if you were to move back a few generations in your own family, they were probably not using much different. And at the time, especially, that's just what a pillow was. So for the original readers of this story, it's not at all strange to mention that the man used a stone as a pillow. It will be significant, however. In verses 12 through 15, God appears to Jacob in a dream. Now, this is a common way for God to speak to people in the Bible. We've already seen it with Abimelech, and we will see it again in prophetic figures like Daniel, and in the New Testament with the likes of Joseph and Paul. So this is a common way for God to speak to people. Now, I would like to give a brief word of warning. There are many who would claim that God has spoken to them in the modern day. If they did not hear from him in a conventional way, like a dream or an audible voice, then it is usually wise to ignore those people, particularly if someone comes to you and says that they are speaking on behalf of God. You need to always be cautious to compare what they are saying to the scriptures to see if what they are saying aligns with them. If it does not, you can tell that God has not spoken through that person. And additionally, if a person is speaking through a dream, it is sometimes difficult to determine which dreams are prophetic and which dreams mean nothing at all. So you should be very cautious with them. We'll see that even Jacob is cautious in trusting his dreams. The point is that we should be extremely cautious and wary about putting words into God's mouth. We don't want to take God's name in vain by saying that God has said something which God has not said. And this is an unfortunately common sin in the modern church. You'll see this in many brick-and-mortar churches. We don't allow it here. And so it's something to be very wary of. Now, in his dream, Jacob sees the angels, who are God's messengers, ascending and descending on a ladder, evidently to make clear to him that God is delivering a message and is coming down to him from heaven. Now, concerning this ladder, there are some who would say that it is a staircase. The Hebrew word is sulam, and it is a hapax legomenon, which is the fancy way of saying that it appears only once in the Bible. That is a theological term that you might want to learn. In any case, since it appears only once in the Bible, there is nothing to which we can compare it. Outside the Bible, it describes either a ladder or a staircase, so we aren't entirely sure which one it is. Ladder is the traditional translation, so we'll just stick with that. Now, what's really important about the ladder is who is at the top of it, and that is Jehovah himself. And he makes promises to Jacob. He promises him many offspring, like the dust of the earth, possession of the land of Canaan. He promises him that all of the families of the earth will be blessed through his descendants, and that he will give him divine protection. Does it sound familiar? It's just like Abraham. That's right. And not only that, but it's just like the promises that his father gave to him. Now, it's very interesting to me that God made these promises to Jacob, because as I have been noting throughout Jacob's story, and will continue to note, Jacob generally does not make wise decisions. He has a very strong tendency to do that which is wrong and deceptive and deceitful. He deceived his father. He deceived his brother. This is the only story I can think of, honestly, in which he doesn't do something that he ought not to do. And we're going to see him making a lot of big blunders next week, so stay tuned for that. But in any case, he does receive these promises, not because of his own works or his own goodness. He hasn't done anything here in fleeing to Haran. He receives these promises because God is giving them to him. It's by God's divine will that he receives them. God also makes an additional promise to Jacob. He promises to bring him back to the promised land. Now, when Jacob awakes, we see his response to the vision, and it is a good response. So, good job, Jacob, on responding well here. First, he marks the location with an anointed stone so that he can know where it was that he met God. This is an important part of his life, which he wants to have a memorial for. He names the location Bethel, which means house of God. Incidentally, Bethel is the same place where God formerly appeared to Abraham, and it will be significant later when God speaks to Jacob again. So this is a place where God's presence is routinely seen. And of course, Bethel will appear throughout the Old Testament. In addition to memorializing the place, Jacob dedicates himself to serve Jehovah if the words of the dream come to pass and he returns to the land. Now, this is significant because, having received this prophetic vision, Jacob looks for a sign that it is actually from God. Even Jacob questions his dreams. So if we simply listen to a person who tells us that they speak for God without any questioning, without seeking any sign, that is a bad way to do business. And of course, if all these things come to pass, Jacob devotes himself to give a tenth of everything to God. He's willing to devote what he has to God's service and to sacrifice what he has to God. Now, how exactly he intends to give that tenth is not fully clear. We presume that he would give it through sacrifices similar to those that are listed elsewhere in the Old Testament. We know that sacrifices had been in practice for since the beginning of time, essentially, when Cain and Abel made their sacrifices. So then, in conclusion, kind of covered a lot of ground here, but to sum it up, we began the book of Genesis talking about the beginning of all humanity, and we have now narrowed the focus to this one ancestor of the family through which the world will be blessed with both good laws and eternal salvation. We have eliminated Esau and his family as the blessed family, and throughout the rest of the Bible, we are going to be focused in specifically on Jacob and his descendants and what happens to them. So then, next week, we will get on to Jacob's misadventures in Haran. For those of you who might be listening to this message away from your computer and are looking for more like it, you can find us at eastjordan.church.